From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Yo, 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 what's up? It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys.
Yeah, that's right.
You've entered the eight diagrams, son. What's up? This is Hunter, joined by Mr. John Grace.
Howdy.
Stuart, we have an update. Stuart has been caught in the yabba. He was traveling, and he was gambling one night and lost all of his money, and last was seen drunk fighting a kangaroo with what's his name? Donald Pleasance. So we are working around the clock to locate Stuart and airlift him to a hospital to get, detoxed. And,
right. You
know, he'll be back on the show in a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. But Stuart did hear last week's show. He was quite – he had a few things to say. He heard it while he was in the yabba. And via Western Union sent me a telegram. A man on a pony rode up to my place today, and he handed me a telegram, and he said, "The mail always gets through," and then he rode off. It's quite intense. But he said, here, I have the telegram right here. I'm going to read it. "Let me clear up something for the listeners from last episode regarding Godzilla. I have only ever seen the Godzilla film from 1998. See, I thought he said 88, but it was 98.
I thought he said 88, too.
Yeah. Oh, well. The one film Godzilla fans dismiss is not a Godzilla film. So, technically, I have never seen a Godzilla film." He's gonna fucking kill me after this. "As for the original Japanese ones, I have no interest in watching a bunch of rubber monsters and a bunch of terrified Japs for 90 minutes. As for the haters of the 98 version, I just picked up the 4K Blu-ray of it today. Cheers, all. Stu."
But he has no problem watching horrendous, unviewable Pacific Rim.
Pacific Rim is terrible, but the 98 Godzilla
is worse. It's one of the worst films I've ever seen in the theater.
It is one of the most cynical movies because, as all Roland Emmerich movies are.
Right.
Who, by the way, Bryan Singer, I mean, that whole, you know, Roland Emmerich, Bryan Singer's Coke and Twink parties thing. Bryce Snellis was talking about it with another gay writer, Alan Ball, today on his podcast.
Yeah.
And he was saying, like, yeah, we all know about these underage Roland Emmerich, Bryan Singer parties. Everybody knows about them here.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy. They talked about it with, like, discomfort. Like, they said they've been invited to them, but they were just, like, kind of a little skeeved out and don't go to that stuff.
Right. So they're not those type of gays.
Yeah, they just kind of seemed like
it's the gay Caligula at those things.
they were just kind of like, they said, what was it? Brady Sadella said he got invited by some other gay writers. They said, "We just kind of go to watch because it's a gas, it's a laugh. You know, it's just you ridiculous." But Brady Sadella was just like, "No, you know." But and he said he knows people who were grown up who used to go to those parties, like, back when they were of age. Now they're past the expiration date and stuff. Yeah. But and they talked a little bit about, like, you know, male sexuality. Like, a 17-year-old is a 17-year-old man. Like, is it different than a girl and stuff? Like, because men are so in their just, like, crazy sexually at that point, you know?
Right.
Whereas girls aren't. You know, they don't get into that until that mindset till they're like mid-30s, you know.
True. Boy, what a spring break movie that would be.
I know,
like,
right?
Cougar Spring Break.
Yeah.
You know, like, these young 17-year-old guys ready to get laid, and then there's, like, all these kind of 30 something cougars. It's like Sex in the City t-shirts and Bon Jovi reunion tour keychains.
I'm gonna go see Poison.
It's just, you know. Well, I guess in that age group, if I say mid-30s, I guess that would be more what? No Doubt. Pearl Jam, I don't know.
Yeah, Pearl Jam for sure. Like,
I've gotten so old, it's like I've aged like 20 years.
Sixpence, None the Richer.
Yeah, culturally, I'm just out of it.
Eagle Eye Cherry.
You know, there was a quote I read because I was looking up to see what the hell happened to Craig Kilborn.
Mm.
And he said something like, in an interview like 3 years ago, he said, well, in truth, my ambition was always to be an old man with a dog. And that's kind of, because, you know, I think he made a lot of money when he was doing those shows and had enough, basically, fuck you money, he could just retire. And so he just had no real goals, just like, done.
Yep.
He's like, listen to jazz in the morning, read the newspaper, and then watch TCM. That's about all he does.
Nice, TCM. So it's like, it's like what my dad wants to be.
Exactly. It's kind of what I'm getting there. You know, I've been doing a marathon and have gun and will travel. I'll give myself a preview of retirement.
But anyways, before the quick tangent, I was just going to say the Roland Emmerich Godzilla movie, by the way, Roland Emmerich, he who loves to devour underage male anus.
I'll see the movie in a whole new light now.
I know. But so he makes this Godzilla movie, but he doesn't have any interest in making Godzilla. It's a Jurassic Park film.
Right.
It's Jurassic Park in the city. It's the final sequence from the Lost World extended.
And with a very cowardly monster.
Oh, the monster. And it goes down like a bitch. Like, Godzilla, like, in the Japanese ones, like, they launch, like, missiles at him, and he's just like, whatever.
Yeah, he's just like anarchy incarnate.
In this one, he's the Roadrunner. Godzilla gets hit with a few missiles, and he's like, oh, I'm dead.
Yeah. Well, supposedly there was this joke going around Japan where the kids would be on the beach playing the American Godzilla. They would run away from the sandcastle. Who knows how real it is, but it's a pretty good joke.
And I liked Godzilla Final Wars. I knew that tuna eating son
kills him in 10 seconds.
And his Sum 41 song is playing during the fight.
Right. With the ultimate insult.
Yeah, I know. Oh, but Stuart, you need to see a real Godzilla movie. That otherwise,
may not get into them. Some things, if you don't see them when you're a kid, they don't resonate with your brain.
True.
And then maybe with these two movies we're talking about today, I actually think classic kung fu films are a hard sell to older people who didn't see them when they were young.
Yeah, and well, I mean, I didn't see classic kung fu movies. Well, maybe I did, and in some light.
Your generation didn't have them on TV all the time.
I didn't see, like, 36 Chamber Shaolin until I was out of college.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. I didn't see it until it came out, like, on Dragon Dynasty. 3
on television when it premiered in New Orleans on New Orleans TV.
Mm.
You know, it was a big – Black Belt Theater was a big deal in the early 80s if you had a UHF channel in your town and you could watch these movies.
I mean, I didn't start consuming Shaw Brothers movies till companies like Weinstein Company, Media Blasters –
right.
All these companies started putting them out.
Well, they were out of circulation for years.
Yeah. I mean, you had to get bootlegs of them.
Guys like me wasted so much of our hard-earned minimum wage dollars trading videotapes and buying bootlegs to collect them because we were just crazy about them.
Yeah. And that's probably why, like you were saying, the like good editions put out by Media Blasters and Funimation and all these companies aren't selling because the audience for these movies don't, they're used to just buying bootlegs of stuff and they don't really care.
Right, right. They don't care about supporting a legit release.
Yeah. Because, like, you, Dragon Dynasty hasn't put out anything new in ages.
No, they're done. That company's done.
Yeah.
Their stuff is still in print, but it's been licensed to, like, a different company because Genis Entertainment, I think, was the name of the company it went under.
Yeah.
That was their manufacturer. Now it's been licensed to where you can buy Dragon Dynasty multi-feature special disc for like $5. I mean, you could get these great transfers of stuff I never conceived of having on video when I was a kid or a teenager. And you get these nice things at Walmart for like $5. You get two movies.
Yeah,
so I would hunt them down. And we'll get into the specifics of what's available when we talk about the films.
Well, this is a show you and I have been wanting to do for a while.
Right.
Ever since Lau. Well, this show is an appreciation of kung fu legend, martial arts master, choreographer, actor, and director, Lau Kar Leung, a.k.a. Liu Jialiang.
Yeah, Liu Jialiang.
Liu Jialiang, and we're just going to refer to him as Liang from now on.
Right.
Just for consistency's sake, because I've always called him Lau Kar Leung, because that's always what I saw. But
Most people do, and I only call him by his Mandarin name because on Black Belt Theater, it was Mandarin credits.
Right, so, I mean, it's just... whatever version you saw, I guess.
Yeah, whatever you're comfortable with. Some fans call him the Pops, just to leave it simple. Because I think maybe his students called him that. They called him the Pops, you know. But that was a British fan nickname, and I don't really know the origin of it. But it may have been one of his students was British, a white British guy named Mark Houghton, I believe was his name. And he, I think he didn't have a problem calling him that. So,
but he came from a kind of prestigious kung fu family. Like, you know, his brother Lau Kar Wing's a famous choreographer, actor.
Yep.
Do you know background on him at all? Like,
Lau Kar Wing, who is Liu Jia Young, is what I always called him for years. He goes as far back as Five Fingers of Death. He was a choreographer for that film. His brother. See, they learn Hungar. Hungar is their big mother system. Mm-hmm. And I believe Liu Jia Liang's grandfather or dad was a student of the real Wang Fei Hung.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah, because I had heard that their kung fu line went back to Wang Fei Hung.
I didn't know if that was true or not. The Hung Fist Dynasty. If you watch a film, I believe it's Heroes 2 that Media Blasters released, there is a sort of trailer that was released to the Hong Kong audience. It's basically a demonstration of the Hung Fist style.
Okay.
And that was when there was this movement in kung fu cinema or Hong Kong action cinema to go from the sword films to the, you know, we would call them boxing films or Chinese boxing movies, is you broke down the style for the audience. Because kung fu is not as mainstream in Hong Kong as you might think. It was really considered like an art for thugs and busboys. And maybe rich kids like Bruce Lee who, you know, would learn to protect themselves. But it wasn't like a big mainstream thing. Not like Taekwondo or Shotokan or Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu are in America.
Right.
It's not, you don't get like, you just get usually poor kids or, you know, rich kids are doing it. It's not like a what we would call a middle class thing or a common thing. So there was this movement towards like real kung fu, not using wires like Jimmy Wang Yu to spring over with your one armed swordsman type of finger. Right. And also, I mean, the hand to hand combat kung fu films were starting to come in even before Bruce Lee made The Big Boss. Contrary to what Milton Harbs might tell you, that wasn't the first film like that. Jimmy Wang Yu was already making movies.
You watch
like
Bruce Lee documentaries, and they really oversell Bruce's impact.
What Bruce
on the
brought
genre
to Hong Kong cinema is the high Korean style kicks that he learned from working out with guys like Junry and Chuck Norris. And they hadn't really seen that because there weren't a lot of good kickers in Hong Kong cinema. And but they kind of opened the floodgate for that. So with Liang, he wanted to have pure kung fu. He didn't want mythology. He didn't want to make a superhero movie. And when he was working with Cheng Che,
Che's choreographer for a long time.
Right. He, with movies like Heroes 2, and he did the Feng Se Yu movies with Alexander Fu Xing, where they're doing real hand-to-hand kung fu. It doesn't look fast by today's eyes. You know, they didn't undercrank it. They didn't over-edit it. These guys were doing long takes with these moves and techniques, and they were shooting them outdoors. They weren't emphasizing the Shaw Brothers sound stages as much back then. Then he made the movie Five Shaolin Masters, which was says directed by Cheng Che. The real director is Liu Xiaoliang, because it's just real kung fu with the cast, well-trained, you know, it's very long takes. The fights are, you know, it's all about the origin of Chinese kung fu in China. Like the five masters fleeing the Shaolin Temple because it's been burned down by the Manchus. And they go off and each is spreading their own kung fu style across China. When the movies we're talking about tonight are on this episode is Eight Diagram Pole Fighter, which I think may have been his last film for the Shaw Brothers.
It wasn't Martial Arts of Shaolin or Disciples of the 36th Chamber?
Here's the kicker. Okay. Eight Diagram Pole Fighter, and then you have I'm trying to make sure. I'm checking the list.
Disciples of the 36th Chamber came afterwards. One of the very last ones.
You are correct. That was actually was not a hit. That was actually a bomb at the box office, believe it or not.
Really?
Yeah, and actually, you notice it's got a bit of a cut budget when you watch that one.
Yeah, it didn't make an impact on me the way the first.
Right. Well, that style of film was just going out of vogue. Like it just didn't make any money. What it is was okay. Eight Diagram Pole Fighter was in progress. It is. Do you wanted to set up the movie and give your thought on it?
Yeah, I just wanted to say like no, you're fine. I just wanted to say like I watched Eight Diagram Pole Fighter and it struck me because, like, the two big Shaw Brothers directors to me are Chang Che and Liu Xiaolang.
Yeah.
And Chang Che's movies, you know, which Liu Xiaolang was very involved in, they are movies that are like about, you know, heroism and brotherhood and revenge and like, you know, shirtless men who are, you know, fighting an enemy, and they're very bloody movies. They all have big sideburns and shining axes, and, you know, one of them will die horribly at the end.
Right.
Like, I think of, was it The Deadly Duo? The, like, guy dies at the end. It's like just statuesque pose fighting, like, and he's like just filled with spears.
You know? Well, it's almost like every hero that dies at the end, because there's always one character that dies at the end, they will fight with like a spear in their stomach or a sword.
Right. their guts will be falling out like in Five Element Ninja.
Yeah, and then as they're laying dying on the ground, they'll always give a speech.
Yeah.
You know?
But so, like, I think of like extreme violence and like these themes of brotherhood and honor and blah, 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 when I think of Chang Che movies. When I think of Liu Xiaolang movies, I think of these are more introspective movies about martial arts. They're more individualistic. They are about the journey of one person through martial arts. Like 36 Chamber of Shaolin starts off like a Chang Che movie would. Like, you know, there's like an act happens. This guy leaves. He has to go get revenge. But he has to go to the Shaolin Temple. But then the movie becomes more about the journey this character goes on.
The creation of a martial arts master.
He goes from a zero to a hero. It's like Rocky almost, except like, you know, he's never even been in a boxing match. You know, like so when at the end of the 36 Chamber Shaolin, because Stu and I talked about this very early on in Midnight Movie Cowboys, and Stu said he was very disappointed in the ending of that movie.
Yeah.
He said he was ready for a nice big final battle. And the final battle in 36 Chamber is a afterthought because the movie is not about the revenge. It starts off as a motivator, but then the movie becomes about a journey. And I think of, you know, you have movies like Heroes of the East, and that's a movie about different styles and culture clash. His movies...
Yeah.
They're about martial arts. They're not about brotherhood and violent. They're not violent films. So when I first saw 8 Diagram Pole Fighter, which I saw it well after I saw a bunch of his other movies, I was very shocked by how what a anguished movie this was. This movie is very violent. It's hideously violent. There there are scenes that are just filled with death, like Gordon Liu just climbing over mountains of corpses. The movie opens with an extremely violent battle scene.
Yeah.
Where Gordon Liu, his entire family is in this. It's a kind of a surreal battle scene. It's a set-bound, stylized Shaw Brothers set.
It's like, I was thinking it was like 300 without the CGI.
Yes, it's without things being sped up and slowed down. Because it's like all black background. But it's an extremely violent opening. And... the rest of the movie, you know, you do have the sort of 36 Chambers thing where this guy goes to become a monk and, you know, he learns a new style and then he goes and gets revenge. But unlike 36 Chamber, his revenge is very violent. You know, he's hitting people in the face. He's ripping their teeth out with his pole. I mean, he learns how to defang people. It's you know, very out of character for Liang. And I wanted to ask you, do you think that the fact that Fu Sheng died while filming had something to do with the tone of this movie? Because it's a very anguished, it's a very angry movie, it feels like.
I wonder about that, and the thing is, when you watch it, the beginning is very gory, and Fu Sheng is on the set.
Fu Sheng was alive. That's what makes me that's what makes me doubt that theory.
Yeah, and I think the tone was darker. I don't really know why he decided that. Maybe because Cat versus Rat really baffled audiences in Hong Kong, and they were like, why are you making this comedy nonsense?
Okay.
It's really strange. I think he wanted to make a very powerful movie because the Yang family legend is a big deal in Chinese folklore. There was even a new version recently that Ronnie Yu directed called Saving General Yang, and it's on Netflix.
This is a family, and like they're all killed except for two of them at this battle.
Right, and I wasn't terribly impressed with the Ronnie Yu film, even though he has all this filming out in the mainland and location work.
And Ronnie Yu's a legit director, too.
Yeah, he's a good director. I enjoy his work, but his movie just didn't compare. It's one of those post-Redcliffe movies that, to me, all look the same.
Right.
I think Liang was planning to make this a more violent movie than usual. And I think Fuxing's death may have, you know, made it. It's possible he cut out any planned humor. Because one thing, the only thing I dislike about some of his films is they'll have this violent setup and then they'll be like this humor that I don't really get. Maybe because I'm not Chinese, although I've been told by Chinese they don't really get the humor either. It's almost like it's like a John Ford film. How the searchers will have a serious scene and then they'll have two drunk Irish guys at the camp goofing off.
Right.
To tell you, throw you out of the tone. And some of his Liang's films are consumed with that type of kind of just out of place humor that slows the story down.
What do you think of, like, cause like I, 36 Chamber of Shaolin is one of my favorite Kung Fu movies. And then there's Return to the 36 Chambers, which is kind of a goofy comedy take on the...
I hated that when I was a kid and I watched it because I thought it was going to be a real sequel to Master Killer, which is what I always called it.
Shaolin Master Killer.
Right.
It's the RZA. We named our first record after the 36 Chambers, Shaolin 36 Chambers, Wu-Tang.
Yeah.
Ain't nothing to fuck with. But my homie Master Killer got his name from Master Killer. Anyways, continue on, John.
Right, the World Northall title was Master Killer. When Crash Cinema released a bootleg of it in the late 90s, it was retitled Shaolin Master Killer because it was thought, okay, if you call something Shaolin, it increases the sales.
Yeah, and it's like putting Ninja in the title or something.
Right, and suddenly that became its alternate title. But it was always Master Killer in the 80s. And that was actually one of those rare films, Shaw Brothers films on TV, that people would ask me about who did not regularly watch Shaw Brothers films. They go, the one I really like is the one where the guy goes through all the tests. Like, they always caught that one and loved it. And it's like, yeah. That, you know, because to them it was like a Western. I even had a student from India ask me about that because he said it was a big hit in India.
Really?
It was one of the biggest Shaw Brothers worldwide hits. It's just so well known. Well, but it's funny
the Indians did put Gordon Liu and Chandy Chuk to China.
Yeah, because he was already a name in that country. They loved him. And it made him a star. And it's funny that he didn't really get to take advantage of that in the 70s and 80s. Like, he didn't get to break out of the Shaw grip and go make films internationally. And yet, he was really beloved around the world. Mm. You know, and it's like, it's kind of cool that Kill Bill kind of gave him that comeback where he started doing international movies before he had his stroke, which we'll get into later. But the film itself, it's like, I don't see any place for humor. And maybe he was planning that as his super serious masterpiece, like his kind of Coppola type movie or something, like The Godfather.
Right. It felt more Chang Che-ish in that it's you know, so brutal, but it did have the sort of individualistic journey that Liang's movies have over, because Chang Che's movies are more like, you know, brotherhood.
Well, it's like basically a traitor leads to the massacre of the family, except for Fuxing goes crazy, so he's back at the home palace, you know, being nuts, and that's the only thing slightly resembling humor, but it's not funny.
I think it was funny at all. It's very
disturbing.
It's over the top, but it's, you know, he's like,
Liu Xiaohui, or Gordon Liu, as we call him, he kind of flees and ends up at a Shaolin temple set up and learns pole fighting and perfecting it because the Yang family use spears. So he's using poles and he wants revenge on the Mongols and the traitor that slaughtered his family. And but the monks don't teach to kill. They teach to, like, when the wolves attack the temple, they knock the teeth out of the wolves.
Yes.
But they don't kill them. They just kind of, you know, knock their teeth out. So when the Mongols, when they finally, you know, trap the Mongols and the traitor in the finale, the Shaolin monks kind of come in and help out. And they basically do not hit. They don't kill the Mongols. They knock all their teeth out with the poles.
And
just
it's
like
fucking brutal. Like, you know, they hit them in the mouth and they pull the pole out and all their teeth are stuck in the pole. And they're like, mouth is this bloody hole. They're like, ah!
Yeah, it's like, we took the teeth out of the wolves. We'll take the teeth out of the Mongols. And it's this kind of like, you know, kind of Zen thing at the end. You know, you carry that metaphor to the end, but it's such a straightforward, dark film with just none of the goofy comedy that plagues some of his other movies, like Legendary Weapons of China, and there's a couple other films that I think are really hurt by too much humor. It's probably his most serious film since Shaolin Manus with David Chang.
Oh, yeah, I haven't seen that one. I need to see it.
That's got a real twist, downer ending, and is a fairly serious film, you know, through most of it, because David Chang was a good actor for that. But here, Gordon Liu, who's sort of like Liang's adopted brother in the Chinese sense of the term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's considered like a member of the family.
Right, and of course, Fu Xing's character disappears through the film because he died during in the midst of filming.
We need to talk about that.
He died in a car crash, right?
He
was driving a sports car. Driving a sports car, and I think Yang Wang-Yu, who's another Shaw Brothers actor who appears briefly in this film to be killed in the beginning, was in the other car. And apparently, Fu Xing wrapped the vehicle around a telephone pole or something. And there may be different details of this crash on the web, but that's what somebody told me who lived in Hong Kong. And he died. And it apparently, I think the Shaw Brothers studio shut down for a few days or like a week in mourning, like, because everybody was a little stunned by it, because Fu Xing was a big star.
One of my favorite Shaw Brothers actors. He's got this youthful
vibrancy. He's the one that a lot of us feel, a lot of us felt like he could have been an international star. He spoke English.
Heard people say that he was poised to be maybe like another breakout like Bruce. Maybe.
He could have totally crossed over
there's a lot of like, you know, how people like to say, oh, the Bruce Lee curse. Wasn't he living in Bruce's old house at the time or something?
I believe so. And
so people
like to go,
ooh, you know?
they say that, but it's just like he was kind of living that fast and loose style and driving a sports car, you know, goofing around. And it's kind of like losing Paul Walker. Do you say there's a curse because Paul Walker was, out street racing in a car that isn't meant to be driven in the streets, you know?
I know, right? No, I mean, but I wasn't suggesting that there's a real curse, but I've heard people go like, oh, you know, he was living in Bruce Lee's house. Perhaps it's the curse. Mm.
And then that house became a brothel, which is the funny thing.
Oh, awesome. Maybe it...
cursed hookers. Apparently, the original ending, Fu Xing was supposed to come back at the end.
Yeah, I was
going to
say, like,
recover.
What was the original intent for his character? Because his character, he's crazy, and then he just disappears from the movie altogether.
Right,
they don't write
to come
him
back
out; he's just gone. You know?
He was supposed to recover, come back, and help out. Excuse me.
Bless you.
Spring allergies. He was supposed to come back and help out his brother at the end, and they would all knock the teeth out of the Mongols. And then I assume maybe he'd have been a crazy fighter or something, doing like a Mad Monkey Kung Fu type thing. But in this film, you also have Wei Ying Hung as the sister, who they refer to by numbers.
There's a lot of that. Fourth brother, third sister.
Right, right. They go by names, which to the Chinese audiences, they kind of know it like the way we know our history, you know, heroes and such, so they know it just as well.
Oh, like, that's the way a lot of these things are. You see, like, a name card pop up, and they go, oh, that's that guy, and this is what's going to happen.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly, and you'll notice on the print, there's the Chinese writing comes up on the side to tell you who different historical figures are.
Yeah, and on the Dragon Dynasty release, there's no subtitles for those, because they're like, people don't know who the fuck these guys are.
yeah, thanks, guys. Thanks a lot.
I really appreciated that.
But it's such a powerful film, and you would think that artificial sound stage at the beginning wouldn't work, but it does. It's just nightmarish. I remember the shock when I saw the father, the Yang father, like jump up on the top of the rock and splatter his head, because that was never in any previous print I had seen.
Yeah.
Except I got a Dutch video version in the 90s that had that scene, but it was cropped so bad you didn't really get the impact of it as bad as watching it.
He breaks his face on that rock. It's insane.
And it's crazy. In that movie, in one of the RZA's books about the Wu-Tang Clan's formation, he's got two of them, he talked about how the entire Wu-Tang Clan was gathered around to watch that movie in an apartment, and they all started crying because they related to brothers dying on the battlefield.
Yeah. Hey, yo, man, you know, some of our brothers, we lost them out in the Brooklyn Zoo, yo.
Yeah, it was like we was crying because we were related to brothers dying on the battlefield.
We lost a homie ODB, and you know, so we thought a homie Gordon, he lost Fu Xing, so we thought we'd name it after 8 Diagrams. You know what I'm saying? Our last
album.
Well,
but I wondered they named one of their last album altogether, I think, 8 Diagrams. Yeah. You know, it was inspired by seeing that movie.
Yes, yeah, for sure. We have 8 Diagrams. You know, like 8 Diagram Bullfighter.
Their love for that movie, but it's a terrific film. It's not my favorite Liang film at Shaw Brothers, but it's definitely a classic.
What's your favorite?
It's one of his best.
Is it Shaw
Brothers? I like Heroes of the East a great deal.
Heroes of the East is my favorite as well.
He hit a peak with that.
Yeah, I mean, because that movie, that is one of the most entertaining movies ever made. It's in my top 10 of all time.
It's of my top 5 kung fu films, it's in there.
I mean, what I was going to say was, this movie did go way up in my estimation watching it a second time.
Yeah. Oh, I bet.
I
love it more every time I watch it. So maybe in a few years it might be my favorite, but I like it quite a bit.
I was just struck by how intense it was. Like, you know, Gordon Liu's character, he loses his family, and you just see him going through this like nightmare hell. Like there's
right.
like corpses everywhere, and it was just so surreal. It was like a Mario Bava movie almost at times.
Oh yeah, yeah. There is a Bava type effect in some of the scenes, and I watched it with the English dubbing. I've never had a problem with that with a lot of the Shaw Brothers films, and the English dubbing is actually kept very straightforward and serious. And some of the lines I just never remember. A lot of the cast like Fifth Yang,
yeah.
You know, or my favorite is at the beginning when just one of them goes, "Kill them all, kill the Mongols." So, But I just love it. And in one of the scenes, I think the traitor says, "Say your prayers." That makes it into a Wu-Tang sample on one of their raps.
So why – because when we decided to do the show, you picked this movie and the next one we're going to talk about. Why did you pick this one?
Okay, this was kind of – the reason I picked the 8-Dragon Pole Fighters is kind of like the peak he was going to hit at the Shaw Brothers studio.
Okay.
And he only – as we said before, he only made one more movie – which was Disciples of the 36th Chamber for the Shaws, and then he went on to do the next film. But he kind of hits his peak working with the actors, getting like that kind of balance. There's some wires in here; they're not like the way they are in the Ching Su Tung films of the '90s or the Chewy Heart type stuff. But it's definitely there.
Kung Fu movie for sure,
right? And there's doubles and enhancement, but it's got an edge, and it's almost like he wanted to make that one last real epic. Angry, bloody epic because of the Fuxing death, but he wanted to make one real serious historical action drama. Then he makes 36 Chambers, or the Disciples of the 36th Chamber, the third 36th Chamber movie, or Master Killer movie, which does not do well at the box office, and it's not a very significant film
like,
either.
I love 36 Chambers so much. I think it's such a great film. And,
yeah.
You know, I say that even though I like Heroes of the East more. I think it's, you know, a masterpiece. So I was so excited to see Return and Disciples of, and both of them were kind of disappointing.
Yeah, they're better the more you watch them, but keeping in mind they're disappointing, and then they improve in your estimate. Like, okay. I saw Return of the Master Killer, Return of the 36th Chamber, at a theater. They had it at the Denver Film Festival. They showed some Shaw Brothers films about 8 years ago. That's where I met Ching Pei Pei. And yeah, the star of Come Drink With Me, she was there.
And Golden Swallow, baby.
Yeah, I asked her about the difference between working with Chang Che and King Hu.
Oh, what'd she say?
She said Chang Che didn't like girls.
Oh, of course, because he's a homo.
Read into that what you want. I mean, a lot of people get pissy if you mention that, but I mean, critics...
Oh, come on!
Because he was married, but it's like pretty obvious when you're watching films.
Chang
Che,
loved,
I mean, I don't diss him.
He
I,
loved
I still
it. No,
love
no, no. Chang Che is a genius. He's one of my favorite directors. But guy liked... Yeah, guy had at least a more appreciation for men than most males. If he was straight, he was dancing on the edge, my friend.
Yeah, right. Or he was.
And his movies aren't homoerotic, though. But they do.
I
have
seen interview footage where he denied it, and he was saying, and he actually says, like, as Freud said, a cigar is just a cigar, or something. Like, he actually says that. Like, he was asked about it.
Well, in his movies, I'm not going to say they're homoerotic. You know, that's such a bullshit thing people do. Oh, the 300 movie is gay. But he has this love of the male form that's, you know, kind of questionable, you know?
Well, Ching Pei Pei said he did not like girls.
Well,
and she meant like he didn't like working with women.
And King Hu's movies are way more feminine, you know?
Right. Well, she implied he was way more meticulous. He took a lot more time to make his movies.
Right.
And he actually, I believe he's the real director of his movies. Chang Che, a lot of his films were really directed by Liang.
Yeah.
John Woo may have probably directed at least
the
two.
The Mob.
Woo Mog, Godfrey Ho worked on one of them as like a second unit. Robert Tai, who I'm Facebook friends with, is said to be the real director of Five Venoms. And
really?
Chang Che was sleeping all the time on the set. And I've heard similar stories, like Richard Harrison had said when he worked on Marco Polo, which was called The Four Assassins on Black Belt Theater, that Chang Che would sleep on the set, show up very late, didn't seem to be the director. You know, it was a kind of like...
I think film fans would be shocked if they knew what really went on the sets, because, you know, I've been on sets and I was like, what's the director doing? You know?
Talking a movie line.
I see the cinematographer doing a lot. I see the cinematographer talking to actors.
Well, some people have told me, like, the cinematographer is sometimes the real director of the
film. I
think
that's why some cinematographers go, I'm going to make a movie. And then they make Transcendence and the press destroys it.
Well, the Liang, yeah, the Liang way was, well, they're going to pull fire. It's kind of like the last great hurrah for Liang at Shaw
Brothers. Well, it felt not like a Chang Che film, but it felt more Chang Che-ish to me. Just
in terms of it's
the,
almost like Liang was saying, this is how I would do a Chang Che film.
Yeah, like this is it's just more violent, but it has a lot of the things that make a Liang movie a Liang film. Mm-hmm. It has his mark on it. And that's why he's the greatest of those directors, because he was the director of his films. He was a martial artist. He could do all this stuff. He could choreograph it. He could map it out. And he could shoot it.
Yeah, and as some have said, it's like if, I think it was Rick Myers or Amy Harlib had written in that book, where they said, if Kung Fu didn't exist, you wouldn't have this film.
No.
It's like these movies cannot exist without the concept of martial arts being, you know, they just don't, you can't make them. Like, you can't make Legendary Weapons of China if Kung Fu didn't exist. You just couldn't make the movie. And in some ways, Eight Dragon Pole Fighter would be very different if you didn't have these martial arts fighting styles in existence. Well, so,
and for people in Region 1, this movie is out from Dragon Dynasty on DVD. I don't think they put out a Blu-ray of it, have they?
No, they didn't. You can get it on DVD. You can find it on Amazon for about, you can find it for like $3.99.
I got the next one we're going to talk about from Dragon Dynasty for $4.
Yeah.
Brand new.
Seriously, seek out Eight Dragon Pole Fighter. It's on Amazon. It's not going to cost you, it costs you less than a Blockbuster rental 5 years.
Yeah, seriously. I mean, just buy it.
You know? It is one you want for the shelf, and you want to watch it, and it's terrific, and you can watch it dubbed or subtitled, your choice.
Either one's
I
fine.
I have no problem with the English dub. It's actually pretty well
done. I like the English dubs of these old movies. You know?
Yeah, they're way better back then than they are today.
Oh, today they suck. Yeah.
Today they're done by like guys in California who don't even try. But back then they were done by people living in Hong Kong who were trying to capture some sort of intercontinental accent, you know?
Yes.
Or spoke like that. The next film is Martial Arts of Shaolin.
Yes, and this is... I want to give my little thoughts on it real quick. With this movie, it stars Jet Li, very young Jet Li.
Yeah.
And I was struck immediately. Anytime I see the Shaw logo come up, I have a certain expectation of how a movie's going to look.
Right.
It's going to be very stylized in the studio, probably have a... a little bit of location work, but it's going to mostly have this sort of bright comic book look. Mm-hmm. This movie had a lot. It was all location work and stunning location work. I mean, it looked like The Last Emperor, which came out the year before this, I believe.
Right.
And it had or the year after, I think. Anyway, it had, like, you see these big castles and, like, these big fields with, you know, rolling hills. I mean, these stunning location work, which threw me off. And you have, like, kind of Canto pop songs. Mm-hmm. So, like, but the movie's shot like an old school kung fu movie. It's shot very straightforward. Like, when I think of 80s, like, late 80s, early 90s Hong Kong movies, I think of montage. Lots of cutting wires, you know, stuff like that. Like the Chui Hark stuff.
Right.
And, I forget the guy's name. But
Ching Su Tung.
Ching Su Tung, thank you.
Who his style became the dominant style.
Yes, Ching Su Tung is the guy. Like, he's the more he's the really influential name that, you know.
Right.
He would drag Seagal's fat ass around on wires and
He actually did. He made a movie in the Belly of the Beast, which Taken is a complete plagiarism of.
It totally is. He's got a Seagal double
that's like 80 pounds lighter doing spin kicks and stuff.
It's
hilarious.
But
and they even do the Chinese ghost story bow and arrow point of view, which is one of his old tricks.
But so for Martial Arts of Shaolin, what struck me was you have the star of the future, Jet Li.
Right.
You have gorgeous, stunning locations, production design. These are kind of hallmarks of the next period of kung fu movies. But the style of shooting and the execution of the kung fu was decidedly old school.
Yeah.
And you had a melding of these two. It was like a crossroads of the sort of Chui Hark, Ching Su Tung school of Kung Fu and the Shaw Brothers, the old way.
Right.
And the movie was just great swashbuckling piece of action cinema as a result, because I prefer kind of the old school, like I could see people do these things. You know, I do like the Ching Su Tung school quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But I do like letting the camera go back and see what's going on and just see these people work their magic. And
right.
seeing that with Jet Li in his prime, phew, wow.
Yeah.
So anyways, what's the background behind this movie? Because it has the Shaw logo, but it's clearly a mainland China movie.
Okay, it's not a Shaw Brothers production. It was a Shaw Brothers pickup that they released in their theaters.
I
believe, financed by a Hong Kong company, but actually, I mean, I've seen different reports that dispute everything.
Yeah, because I noticed at the end it had credits. It didn't say, like, the end, another Shaw production. You know?
Right, okay, what happened was in 1979 or 1980, depending on what source you read, Jet Li made a film called The Shaolin Temple, which was the first Kung Fu film produced in mainland China since the 1930s, you know, or whenever they quit making films in the mainland.
They started just anything.
It was just a Hong Kong, Taiwan thing. And most Kung Fu films you see before 1980 are filmed in Hong Kong or Taiwan. What they did was they made The Shaolin Temple, and it was directed by mainland talent. I think the director may have actually been a Hong Kong or Taiwanese guy, but the quality was superb. Like, it was extremely well photographed. In fact, you know, Argento said that the Kodachrome he used for Suspiria, the rest of it was sent to mainland China. And I actually wondered if they used it on this film, because it's Shaolin Temple is a beautiful looking movie. You just didn't see Kung Fu films look like that. It looks like David Lean directed it. You know, the location work is all in the mainland. They shot on one of the restored Shaolin Temples. Not restored to what we know today to be the tourist attraction, but where they believe one of the locations of the actual temple. It was a huge hit in mainland China. They do not, contrary to what you might think, they did not regularly see Bruce Lee or Shaw Brothers or seasonal films in mainland China. They just didn't allow those films in that market, or it varies sparingly, you know. And so Jet Li
inspired the people to rise up and smash us.
Right. Jet Li was a Red China wushu champ. In China, they kind of banned kung fu styles and learning it as a fighting art, and they turned it into a performance art called wushu. So there's a lot of dispute over whether what they're doing is real kung fu, because it's basically performance, dance, acrobatics. It looks beautiful on film, though. It's because it's perfect for cameras, because it's for show, it's for display. So the movie is incredible. The fights look very different. They're long takes. And Liu Chaliang was a advisor on the film when they actually filmed one portion where Jet is doing his incredible wushu forms. And you can see the clips on YouTube at the Shaw Studios on the soundstage. Like, different sound stages, they're using Shaw sets. And Liang was an advisor. And I had heard that there was actually a dispute where the mainland crew was like, we don't really like your movies because you're not... your stuff isn't real, and we've got real martial artists. Like, they didn't respect Liang or something. You know, it's a rumor, though. But that one scene was shot at the Shaw Brothers, and I believe the Shaw Brothers released Shaolin Temple in Hong Kong in their theaters. They owned a chain of theaters, so it was kind of like the old days of Hollywood.
Yeah, it's like the old studio system.
Right. So Shaolin Temple is a gigantic hit. It's just a huge hit. Makes Jet Li, he's going to be the next big thing. Problem is, he's in Red China. They're not working.
Behind the iron curtain, folks.
Right. It's like, but they're not going to allow him to go to Hollywood and work in a film in 1981 or 82. Right. So he makes a sequel, Kids from Shaolin. That's a hit. So then Liang's kind of done with the Shaw Brothers, depending on who you want to believe. And he is invited to direct the next Jet Li Shaolin Temple film up in mainland China. So he directs Martial Arts of Shaolin. Now, here's the interesting thing. If you watch the previous two Shaolin Temple movies, it's impressive looking. They look terrific, but they don't look like they're really fighting. If you're a martial artist and you know movement and you know the way a fight is supposed to look for a martial artist,
it looks like they're dancing or something.
Right. It's almost like a dance. It looks great. It's exciting, but it just doesn't look the way the Shaw Brothers films look, where those guys are doing kung fu.
Shaw Brothers movies look like they're whipping the shit out of each other.
They're really going at each other. It might be choreographed. It might have all these elaborate moves, but they still look like they're fighting. And Liang was the best at that. As far as I'm concerned, greatest kung fu director that ever lived. So Liang gets to work with this mainland crew of wushu champions. Most of them were champion wushu guys. And in real masters like Pan King Fu, who, strangely enough, one of my kung fu teachers actually hosted him here in America for a month and stayed at his place. Mm. He plays one of the old Shaolin monks. And there's a real, like, the guy playing the villain was, like, an actual broadsword champ in Wushu championships and stuff. Liang is able to work with this talent, doesn't need to double him, doesn't have to do trick editing to make him look better, like when he's working with actors like Fuxing, who he trained for the films. You get these long takes of just perfect kung fu movement, but they look like they're fighting because Liang's doing the choreography. So you get... Johnny Ray Gasca had said to me, he said, this is basically, he considered it the next level for Liang. Mm. Like when a director hits his next level, that's when he's making his best work.
Yeah.
Like he's going to something else, like getting out of the Shaw studio and making this film on real location work. And they film in the Forbidden City. They did it before, Bertolucci's The Last Emperor.
Did they do it before? Because that was one of the things about Bertolucci's Last Emperor, was they were like, because I thought, I was like, that looks like the Forbidden City.
It is. They did it before. They actually filmed it before.
Okay,
they were
always like, oh, it was the first feature film to film in the Forbidden
City. First European financed film.
Yeah, the first big. What do you think of Last Emperor?
I haven't seen it in years. I don't remember if I had a good impression of it or not.
I saw it a year or so ago, and I thought it was really good.
I saw it when I was a high school kid, when it was in Cinemax aired it, and I just don't remember much about it. And that's not the best way to view it, as a pan and scan.
No, you know. Yeah, because it's a very visual. It's got the Vittorio Storaro cinematography. It's just beautiful movie. But I saw it like a year or so ago, and I quite liked it. And I was worried it would be, since it's Bertolucci, I was worried it was going to be like Red China propaganda.
Right.
which it really kind of wasn't. It was kind of a really sad story about this person born into this life. But anyway,
right.
But this movie made me think of it because I was thinking, that looks like the Forbidden City.
Because it was.
Yeah, but I wasn't sure. I tried looking it up, but I couldn't figure it out.
And who knows if this is true, but I think they actually acted like it was the first time they filmed, probably the first time they filmed a kung fu film in the Forbidden City.
I mean, but it's, I mean, because I'm used to sort of the small Shaw Brothers sets, which are bright and they have these colorful things, but there was just a massive scope to this movie because
right.
You had those giant walls and you had the giant hills and stuff. And it was just, I was like, man, this is great.
Right. And also they filmed a fight scene on the Great Wall of China.
Yeah, they did. I was like, holy shit, are they on the Great Wall?
And believe me, in 1985, whenever they filmed this, that was a big deal.
Yeah.
It was a huge deal. That was like, it was pretty innovative. And so Jet Li, this is before his injuries that he sustained filming Born to Defense, or Born to Defend, depending on the translation you see.
His face looked less fucked up.
Well, okay. On the set of Born to Defense, which was his directorial debut, it was later finished by another director when Jet was injured. The director's name was Cha Ming Chui, I think is his name. He made a really good film called Bury Me High that I liked a lot. He made another film on the mainland called Mirage that I cannot find a copy of.
Bury Me High, that's a good name for a stoner metal band.
Bury Me High is an amazingly fun movie. I saw it in Chinatown twice. I thought it was great. And I'm looking for an anamorphic DVD, so if anybody knows where I can find one, let me know.
Johnny Ray. What's up, homie? You gotta help out my homie Johnny here.
You might know, but I've got a basic DVD, but I know that they did put out a Fortune Star anamorphic that I'd like to get a hold of. But I'm hoping it'll come out on Blu-ray, and then I'll just be relieved. Oh, that'll solve all problems. But Jet injured his back really bad on the set of Born to Defense. And he also broke his jaw. Now, here's the thing. In Martial Arts Shaolin, you see Jet at his peak. Although, according to the IMDb, Yan Yan Hung, who is also, depending on what name you know his translation, but I've always called him Yan Yan Hung because a friend of mine, Garrow, who met him on the set of Once Upon a Time in China in the West, or Once Upon a Time in China in America, I forget the title.
Yeah,
That's what they called him. So I was like, he's Yan Yan Hung. Yan Yan Hung was doubled, supposedly, according to the IMDb, he doubled Jet in this film. I didn't really see the doubling very obvious,
I couldn't spot any.
Yeah, I couldn't spot it. So I don't know how true that is. But Yan Yan Hung became Jet's fight double for the Once Upon a Time in China films after the Born to Defense filming went so badly. And Jet just never recovered 100% from those injuries and did not have the movement that he had in these Shaolin Temple films.
How did he hurt himself? Like, what was he doing?
Cause like, I don't know, and I know it caused problems in the filming. And it's obvious when you watch Born to Defend that it was plagued with some production problems, and not really sure what happened there.
I never heard about this, because, you know, Jackie's Armor of God fuck-up was, pretty legendary. And he was
right.
A pretty basic stunt, and so hearing about this, I'm like, oh, this is new to me.
Right, and it's because Jet was the mainland star. He wasn't the
he wasn't a
Hong Kong star yet, and he wasn't really a star in Hong Kong until he did Once Upon a Time in China.
Yeah, he started working with Chewie.
Then he was the biggest star going. And the thing is, on the set of Martial Arts Shaolin, he and Liang did not get along, and they never worked together again ever.
Really?
Yeah, they never did.
Liang didn't get along with Jackie either on Legend of Drunken
Right,
Master.
And I think Liang was more demanding of Jackie than Jackie wanted. Jackie wanted to do his swing arms and do stunt work for Drunken Master 2. And Liang was like, no, we're going to do real Kung Fu because Wong Fei Hung is a Hungar guy and you're going to do Hungar. And we're going to do the fights with the spears and the movements have to be precise. And I don't think Jackie liked that.
Well, and I think it almost seems like because, you know, Liang's a real martial artist.
Right.
And, you know, Gordon Liu was somebody he worked with as a martial artist.
Mm-hmm.
And it almost seems like, you know, those people, that inner circle, they probably worked well together. And
yeah.
Then you have, like, a star like Jackie come in, and it's like, who the fuck are you telling me what to do? I'm Jackie Chan.
Right,
you know?
Right. Well, Jackie Chan would say something like, well, Liang was too old school or old style.
Right.
And it's like, which Jackie hates fighting like that. He hates it where every move has to be precise and you have to remember. Like, he likes to fight with his stuntmen where they can, like, almost improvise their fights if they have
right.
to.
He's,
like,
he's
his
a,
stuntmen
he's a
know
jazz
his
player.
Movements. Yeah, it's like, he's very rigid. It's like, okay, Frank Zappa was famous for playing what sounded like improv music, but actually they memorized everything.
Yeah, he did.
And that's the Jackie Chan way of doing things, whereas Liang is very precise and it has to be, you know, to the note.
But like,
and
Jet Li wasn't a massive star yet, though, was he? When
he was a big star in the mainland.
So
he was a big star in Japan.
Would he have been
yeah.
the type of guy who'd be like, "Who the fuck are you, old man? Telling me what to do?" You know,
he may not have gotten along just because Liang might be too demanding. I'm
yeah.
not really sure. The interesting thing is, I used to be Facebook friends with. Conan Lee, who he's no longer on Facebook because he apparently had a lot of projects going on, but he's a guy who's got that reputation of being difficult. The interesting thing is he got along great with Liu Jialiang and worked with him on several films.
Huh.
And Yan Yan Hung, if you believe that he was Jet's fight double in Martial Arts Shaolin, did work with Liang in Aces Go Places 5, The Terracotta Hit, which Liang went to direct when he kind of returned from mainland China. He did Aces Go Places 5 was one of the films he did for Cinema City as a comeback, along with Tiger on Beat. And Aces Go Places 5 was kind of a kiss ass to the mainland Chinese. And the funny thing was, it was released in American Chinatowns the week of the Tiananmen Square massacre. It was booed
really?
Out of the theaters. It went, according to a friend who saw it in Boston, like they were pretty pissed off about it. And
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Right, and so with this film, which I don't know what its box office take was, I know that Gasca had said when it played in New York at the Chinatowns, it didn't get a good reaction from the fans, and he said at that time he felt like maybe there's such a thing as giving an audience too much when they're not ready for it.
Right. No, I
he
think
said,
that's absolutely true.
Just the style and everything, and this, which is funny because when I saw it, I had like somebody sent me a Japanese Laserdisc dupe onto a VHS tape, and it was widescreen, and this is back when movies were not widescreen very often on video, and
right.
it just looked beautiful. The colors jumped out at me.
Oh.
I'd never seen a Kung Fu film look like that, you know, along with Shaolin Temple. It was just a totally new thing, and just with the Liang choreography, it was just, you know, there's like fight scenes in there that you appreciate more if you studied martial arts. Not that you have to study martial arts to enjoy these type of films, but you know more about the movement, what they're trying to say physically, than somebody who's no experience with that sort of thing.
Right.
Some people will praise Ong Bak, and I'll say, well, Ong Bak's, the choreography is repetitive.
The problem with Ong Bak is that it has a garbage story.
It's Kickboxer. There's a friend of mine who just basically discovered it. He said it's Kickboxer 5 when it, comes to the script. You know, it's not very good.
No,
but
he thought visually it was exciting. That's the problem with those Thai action movies is that, yes, they have really cool action and stuff, but God, the stories are like, they're written by retards. Like, they're just terrible.
Well, this is the funny thing about Martial Arts of Shaolin. I love it so much. It's one of my five favorite films. There's two Liang movies in my top five. But the story is so simple, it could be a fairy tale. It's like a children's story.
It really is. It's like, you know, the leg bells, like Jet Li. Like, the story, we haven't really talked about the story at all. The story of this movie is Jet Li. There's a kind of a coup, I guess, in China. Where this guy who's clearly bad because he laughs like,
right,
all the time. He sees his power. Meanwhile, Jet Li's this Shaolin Temple fighter, and he finds out about it, and he has sworn to kill this guy, and he goes to assassinate him, and he meets up with two other people who are secular Shaolin fighters, or one of them is, and they are hell-bent on killing this guy as well. So it's kind of a basic revenge story, really. But there's also like kind of these fairy tale elements, like this Jet Li has this bell on his leg, and he meets the girl, and she has a bell on her leg too. And she says, like, if it's a girl, we're supposed to be there's one other person out there with these that I'm seeking. And, you know, if it's a girl, we're supposed to be sisters. Mm-hmm. If it's a man, we're supposed to marry each other. And Jet Li is a monk, so he can't do that. And he's like torn up about it.
Well, the thing is, there's no wires, editing.
I didn't notice any. I mean, it's very old school the way it's shot. You know, you see everything that's going on. There's not a lot of montage or any of that stuff that I kind of associate with that period, with what would become that period. Because, like, you know, it's got the pop songs in it, and the the synth.
Yeah,
score.
Which are actually sung in. They're actually sung, I believe, in Mandarin.
I always use the term canto pop as a catch-all, but I know, like, that's probably an ignorant, you know, application.
Yeah, cantopop is basically only heard in Hong Kong films of the 80s and 70s, if you watch the Hui Brothers films, because Sam Hui kind of invented cantopop. But before that, Hong Kong singers were often singing English. Also, you see Jet Li in his kind of youthful persona, whereas in later films, he's always stoic or brooding or kind of, if it is American films,
I'm not
it's
used
one
to seeing him being funny. Word. You know?
Right.
Because like, he reminded me of kind of
funny
some of
over
Jackie's
here,
early stuff, where he's kind of a bumbling goof, you know?
Right. And you'll read like ignorant critics like Owen Gleiberman say they don't get the Jet Li act and they don't understand the appeal or whatever, and it's like, well, because you're watching him in an American film where they don't know how to handle his personality.
Oh, that always happens like when those guys come over here. It's like they don't know what to do with them.
Yeah, everything I said about Chow Yun Fat coming to America came true.
Well, it's like
they'll have no clue. You know.
Well, and you were telling me today. I know this guy's not Asian, but you said today online that like Gareth Evans got offered all this money to do another Die Hard movie, and I said, I can't think of a bigger waste of talent than Gareth Evans doing a Die Hard movie.
From what I've heard, he was offered a lot of big projects, and he just had no interest.
Well, and
you know, not just Die Hard, like it was other sequels, and he was just like, I don't care, I'm doing my Raid movies in Indonesia, leave me alone.
Good, I mean, that's perfect, but somebody said, oh, I'm sure if he did those, that would have been better than what we're getting, and I was thinking, why would you? I don't care if Gareth Evans turns in a digestible Die Hard movie. It's still a fucking Die Hard movie. Like, why would you want to see another movie where Bruce Willis can't be bothered to give a shit?
Exactly.
I mean,
where's the paycheck?
I mean, yeah, Bruce Willis, like, I mean, did anybody? I understand people went to go see Live Free or Die Hard, and I do not understand why. I don't know if it made money or not. I think it was a bomb, actually.
The last Die Hard movie flopped.
But they're apparently making another one. Why?
Supposedly, I heard that's actually a fan script.
I hope so because fuck me. I mean,
and I'm going to be really honest with you before any of you listeners go, hey man, on Dark Horizons. I don't read those sites anymore. I don't even care about upcoming movie news. I don't give a damn. Some people will tell me stuff on social media. That's the only way I find out. I just don't care. I don't really have interest through social media.
I don't go to joblo.com, Ain't It Cool News,
I don't care what Marvel piece of shit you're jacking good enough to right now.
Because they're all it is superhero movie news. That's all those sites are, superhero movie news.
Same shit. It's just the same stuff, and it's redundant. And until my kid's old enough to see them, I'd have no urge to go out and see those, you know, first week. I'll wait for them to hit the second run. Right. I haven't seen Winter Soldier yet. I don't think either of us have.
I haven't either. Like, I did see The Raid 2, though.
I'll pay, yeah, right, you should go see The Raid 2, the hell with Winter Soldier. But I'll see Winter Soldier when it hits the Elvis Cinema for $250 a ticket, you know?
I did almost go see Turkish Captain America, though. They were playing that at the Draft House, but alas,
that's probably
a
more honest
event.
Film.
Yeah.
Probably way more honest. But man, Winter Soldier's a masterpiece. Yeah, I'll just forget about Godfather 2 when I see Winter Soldier. Yeah.
Well, and like, you know, everybody was like talking about how good Thor the Dark World was. The movie's not... I fell asleep the second time I saw it. I saw it in the theater, I thought it was all right, and then I was like, I'm going to try it again, and I fell asleep. I was just like...
I took my Toyota to the shop to get some recall work done, and that's when I went to see it, about 2 months after it was released. Because I had like... I had that 2-hour gap, and I was like, oh, I'll go see a movie because they had a 10 a.m. showing. So I saw that, and I was like, oh, that was pretty nice for a Fox movie of the week.
Yeah, yeah. Huh.
Yeah, I was like, that'll play fine on TV.
The Incredible Hulk TV movie was a better Thor movie.
I mean, it's just like I just forgot about it. Like, literally an hour after I saw it, I was like, oh, I saw a movie this morning. I saw Thor. You know,
yeah,
I saw Dark World Thor.
It and I went, yeah, it was all right, and then I just forgot about it. You know,
Rene Russo dies, and I just completely forgot.
Yeah, I know, right?
These movies just don't have any weight in my. I don't feel them. There's no feeling with these things. It's not 8 Diagram Pole Fighter. I'll put it that way.
No, 8 Diagram Pole Fighter is, man. The atmosphere of that movie just is really powerful. Every time I see it, I can't take my eyes off of it. It's
yeah, and there's an emotional charge to seeing stuff like that that has real. Okay, maybe they're really caricatures or archetypes. They're not real characters the way we know in American films. But when I watch the movies, I get like there's an effect with seeing the characters go through this stuff that I don't get out of American films, where you can download Kung Fu into your brain in The Matrix and you know it. You know, yeah. I don't feel anything. I'm a cubicle slave and now I'm a hero. You know, I don't relate to that.
No,
you know, martial arts skill is something
that sounds like a nerd fantasy, really. You know.
It is, and that's what that stuff is. It's the video game generation that never gets out of the house that thinks, you know. I have literally heard people talk about motorcycle riding or flying, and I'll realize they're talking about a video game.
Oh, my God.
And they'll talk about this like they've really done it. There's no exaggeration, because I work in a, you know, the type of cubicle farm job you can imagine, and I'm just like, you got to be kidding me. That's why I don't even allow video games in the house. I don't even want that reality here.
Oh, have kids, if I ever have kids, God willing, I can't see myself allowing that. In fact, I don't even want my kids having iPads. You know, like,
And it's like
I see a lot of kids. I see they have iPads and stuff, and I'm just like, no, you know.
Nah, it's like, and I'm not slamming anybody who plays video games, whatever.
No.
But
no, I mean, I play video games occasionally. You know, I grew up.
I've wasted time playing pinball. Yeah. I go to the pinball museum at Manitou Springs and I go crazy on those machines, you know, because some of them you can still run with a nickel.
My parents were kind of not a fan of having video game consoles when I was growing up. And
right.
I understand why.
Yeah. Well, it can kill your attention span and it can be a lot of waste of time. And I don't allow it in the house right now. My son turns 18 and go buy one. I don't care.
Yeah.
You know, by then it'll be like the Lawnmower Man and you're, you know, fighting giant Jeff Fahey's. In cyberspace, I have no idea.
Yeah, I know.
But
Jeff Fahey.
I just thought of that because I had a crackhead lawnmower guy like knock on my door today. Apparently, they can't read no soliciting signs.
He looked just like Jeff Fahey.
No, not at all.
More like Pierce Brosnan, right? No,
he looked like Trini Lopez. But but going back to these films. There's no when you watch these as compared to like the 90s Hong Kong films that everybody went crazy for some reason, and which I find do not hold up with the Ching Su Tung type action. I really feel like the old school stuff of the martial arts of Shaolin is not inspired by Japanese cartoons or video game technology or imagery. Whereas I think the 90s films have that Japanese cartoon influence because stuff like Dragon Ball Z was getting huge in Hong Kong.
Right.
And I don't think I'm too crazy to come up with that stuff because I think a lot of that comes from like a, you know, kind of that Japanese culture coming into Hong Kong and the cartoons being big with the kids.
Yeah, the and Dragon Ball Z was a very Chinese.
Cartoon. It was inspired by Jackie Chan movies. They admitted it.
Yeah,
inspired by Chinese legend.
Like it, yeah, it's Journey to the East. He's the Monkey King, you know.
Right. It's the Monkey King story, which is one of their great fairy tale folklore legends, whatever you want to call
it. Yeah, I mean, you see it pop up in tons of movies,
Two recent ones, the most recent Donnie Yen movie is The Monkey King, which I hear is terrible, but
And Jet Li played him with Forbidden Kingdom or whatever with Jackie Chan.
Right, The Forbidden King, which I thought was a decent film. Yeah, I didn't have a problem with it. Some fans hate it, but I didn't have an issue with it.
I thought it was all right. I saw it once and enjoyed it. But
my expectations are so low for stuff now that's like, that was all right, you know. But the new Stephen Chow film, Journey to the West, is pretty brilliant take on the legend.
Oh, I need to see it. I love Stephen Chow.
You'll have to see this. He's not in the film. That's the interesting thing.
But I remember Dragon Ball and Dragon Ball Z and all that. Just the way the imagery of it was always very Chinese. You had like Krillin was a Shaolin Temple type character.
Mm-hmm.
He had the burns on his forehead. You know, they all wore the sort of Chinese looking geese. They had the dragon was very Chinese. You know, it wasn't. It was more inspired by their culture than the Japanese culture. You know, but it was very Japanese in that it had, like, you know, the hyperkinetic elements to it.
Right, and the artists were very inspired by, I think, the Jackie Chan film was the late 70s and the seasonal movies and such.
I remember, because I watched Dragon Ball Z when I was in high school. I thought it was a fun cartoon to watch. Akira Toriyama had talked about Jackie Chan films because there's that sort of bumbling Jackie Chan humor in it with like Son Goku. He's like, you know, he eats a lot and, you know, he's kind of dumb, you know, but he's also a badass fighter, you know.
What's interesting, because I think I've read that Jackie Chan hit it big in Japan before he hit it big in Hong Kong, because apparently one of the films he did for Lo Wei, To Kill with Intrigue, which is not really an exceptional film other than it's straightforward and serious, was a hit in Japan but was a bomb in Hong Kong. But so when Jackie made like Drunken Master and Eagles, Snake and the Eagle Shadow, those were huge in Japan. Like, he was, and it's actually very rare for a Chinese star to hit it big in Japan.
You know, and all you have to do is get big in Japan. That's all you got to do.
Hey, well, Jackie had a guaranteed audience in Japan, so that's how he ended up doing City Hunter.
Look at the movie Anvil, the story of Anvil. Like, they play everywhere else in the world. Nobody comes up. They go to Japan, huge crowd.
Yeah. One of my favorite bands is YNT. They're huge in Japan. Yeah. It's like they have guaranteed money. If they go to Japan, they can pay their rent for a year, probably. Yeah. But the interesting thing about Liang and his films, okay, Shaw Brothers films, overall, not big in Japan, but Liang's films were popular in Japan. They had a following.
It's because he showed this is the RZA.
Yeah, he doesn't disrespect them.
He doesn't disrespect the Japanese in movies like Heroes of the East.
Exactly.
He gives it proper respect. You know,
it's an honor thing. Jimmy Wang Yu was also strangely huge in Japan, even though his films are the most vehemently racist against the Japanese that you can imagine.
I don't get that, because, you know, a lot of Shaw Brothers movies, you know, you got the Japanese menace, you know, you got the dastardly Japanese twirling their mustaches, you know.
They didn't like Chang Che. It's strange. They did not seem to. There doesn't. Okay, when I was collecting this stuff, the best thing you could get were uncut foreign videotapes from Holland, where they had released a ton of Shaw Brothers films on Warner Brothers' label. Warner Brothers released a ton of them on home video in Holland, didn't care about releasing them in the U.S. But in Japan, Warner Brothers had released some Shaw titles. The only things you could really get were like Liang films.
It's because he showed them respect, son.
Right, because Liang had a following there. Like, it's like they liked his films. They liked Gordon Liu. I've seen photos of Gordon Liu visiting Japan to do a press tour.
How's he doing? Do you know?
Okay, he had a stroke a couple of years back and kind of making recovery. Last I've seen, he doesn't look too good in the pictures. But
I saw a picture of him and he was standing up and he had like a cane and he looked.
Yeah.
He looked kind of pissed off.
Yeah, he looked like an old man, which is strange, because it's funny, because a couple of years ago he was going to teach a seminar in Florida and I seriously considered going, and then when I heard about a stroke, I think I knew, well, he's not going to make that. No. And it was just Ching Quan Tai down in Florida, and maybe eventually I'll fly to one of these things and take a Ching Quan Tai seminar, but I was really going to do it if it was Gordon Liu.
Oh yeah, I would too.
You know, even if I'm just learning this kind of stage fighting Hungar or whatever he's teaching. You
Speaking
know.
Of flying to learn, didn't Lao Karlung, or didn't Liang have a sort of school like Lao Family Kung Fu?
Yeah, he did in, I believe, in Hong Kong.
Before. Yeah, and you could go and, like, you kind of learned the sort of movie style of Kung Fu.
Well,
kind of.
I think he taught real Hungar, and okay. I told his students could use Hungar in a real fight. Right. You know, the kind of stereotype of Kung Fu, well, it's good, looks good in the movies, or it's good against an untrained opponent, but it doesn't really work. But they say that Liang's students could use the Hungar in a real fight. Like, they could,
but
you know.
Wasn't it like you just, like, paid some money and you'd go, like, stay there for a while and learn? And
possibly. I don't know what the format was. The interesting thing is, about 8 years ago, I saw a video, YouTube clip of Liang at age, like, man, I don't know if he was 60, 61. He was in his 60s at least. And he's doing a Hungar form, and he is so fast and amazing. Like, hadn't lost a step. And he had recovered from cancer. He had beaten the cancer that time out. And he looked awesome. And I said, you know what? I need to start taking a martial art again because I've been laying off for like 20 years. It's time to get back in it.
Well, and you know, I mean, martial arts is great because, you know, like lifting weights and getting swole is one thing. But like
right.
learning to be an athlete, you know, like mm-hmm. martial arts is where you do that.
That's, well, you get your it's reflexes and balance. And yeah. I took a Chinese style for the first time. And ended up taking like two Chinese styles to kind of just get a feel for it. But
Kami John, is that what you are?
No, not at all. In fact, my teacher had told me, he says none of the really good martial artists were in China. They were in Taiwan.
Oh.
And he said the really dangerous
the training
guys
to
were
fight off the Chinese when they invade.
He said, think about it. He goes, Taiwan told mainland China to go to hell and don't come on this island. And it's like, that's where all the tough guys were. He said, that's where all the real martial arts.
That's where all of Chiang Kai-shek's followers were. And that guy looked like he bit the heads off of bats, you know.
Yeah, they're mean guys. And he said, but that's where all the really good instructors were. And it's Hong Kong and Taiwan is where you probably find the best Chinese kung fu schools in, you know, on the Asian continent.
Wow.
But mainland China, it's wushu. You know, the Shaolin monks you see touring the U.S. are not real Shaolin monks. They're wushu performers, kind of hired and trained to be Shaolin monk performers.
Right.
They're not, you know, when you talk to them in martial arts, they just don't have a clue. They love video games. But but they're not for real. It's like they're not legit. Like the Shaolin Temple was burned years ago. You know, plus the People's Revolution, when that happened, like all of China's past was kind of erased for a while.
Oh, it was the old way, you know.
Yeah, it was like that wasn't considered the way because it was like, no, we're all atheists now or whatever.
Yeah, that's
really changed.
that's not part of the revolution, son. You know?
Right, right. And the People's Revolution just kind of tried to erase a lot of that stuff and the banning of martial arts. And
Maoism was so fucked up.
I know. It's like, it's funny how that's kind of soft-sold over here as like it wasn't any big
deal. Oh my gosh, it was a disaster. So many people died because of their fucked up agriculture policies.
Right.
It was insane. Like, just ridiculous. It was, Stalin did the same thing.
Yeah.
These communists and Pol Pot, all these communists with their agrarian reforms slaughtered their people. You know?
Unbelievable. It's just, it's horrible to even think of the astounding numbers of people died for such stupidity.
It dwarfs the Holocaust, and, you know, the Holocaust was really fucking bad, you know?
Right, it's like, but then when you look at this, it's like, oh my god, this is actually worse.
The number's so high, you can't even wrap your head around it.
I don't even like to think about it, it's so depressing.
And then the way they would kind of trick people out, the naive Chinese and Cambodians and stuff, they would say, like Mao would say, oh, let 100,000 flowers bloom, you know, let 1,000 flowers bloom. Let the freedom of thought come forward. And then anybody who said, well, we don't like your ideas about this, taken the re-education camps and killed, you know.
Right.
And when in Cambodia, they'd say, like, who of you was an intellectual? Who of you, like, you know, was this, that, and the other thing? And so people would be like, you know, we want to, you know, embrace you. We want to, you know, help you. And they'd come forward, and then they'd take them and kill them.
Yeah, and it's the thing about, like, in Hong Kong in the 90s, their films were depressing to watch because they were in such fear of the mainland taking over Hong Kong.
Oh, I mean, there was a cloud over that country in the late
and
90s.
And so much talent was going to Canada, was getting Canadian citizenships and trying to establish residency.
And John Woo and Chui Hark fled to to the U.S. to...
Yeah, Chewie ended up kind of running, like, he had no problem with the mainland once they took over. Yeah. Like, he was trying to set up, he's like, okay, I can't fight this, I've got to, this is where my industry is.
Well, and I thought he kind of figured out, I heard he was worried he was going to prison.
Right.
Or something, because he'd made some anti-communist stuff.
Right, and he kind of figured out a way to get along.
Because, like, we're going to eat you, like, as far as I remember, there were, like, commie cannibals in that movie.
Yeah, and also they're playing with fire, which I haven't watched in years, but that's his most political film. I think it was actually censored before it was released in Hong Kong.
I'm actually going to school where Chewie went to school.
Oh, that's right.
got my acceptance letter today.
Right, and then with John Woo, he was already like, that was the number one name of Hong Kong that Hollywood wanted. They were looking at him, supposedly they had screened A Better Tomorrow at Universal Studios, like even before John Woo was a big name with the cult fans over here, you know.
Yeah.
Like, they said, does this guy, supposedly the president of Universal is like, does this director speak English? And they said, he's learning. So, yeah. It's like, that was the story. Because I think a Hong Kong movie fan who had a relationship with the people at Universal, he went and took a video of A Better Tomorrow or had a print screened, and they were like, okay, we got to get a hold of this guy. That's how he ended up making Hard Target a few years later for Universal.
Yes, and his career was over, pretty much. not over, but like... You know, Chow Yun-fat sliding.
Well,
he
made all his money in America. Money wise, his career was...
Oh, his career was great, but I'm talking about creatively. Just
yeah,
like, you know, I look at Chow Yun-fat.
I think honestly, yeah.
I was just gonna say, I look at Chow Yun-fat sliding down that railing, shooting guns. He looks fucking awesome. Christian Slater does it in Broken Arrow, and he looks like a retard. You know, like
it just looks dumb.
I mean, the only movie of his that feels like classic John Woo to me that he did over here was Face Off. And
yeah, it's
being kind of generous.
It's closer.
But,
well,
you know, like,
I
Paycheck,
mean, honestly think he kind of burned. I think he burned out a bullet in the head. I think he used every idea that he had and he was done.
Yeah, I mean, that's one I haven't
seen. People get pissed when I say that. Like, oh, I need him to make another movie with Chow Yun-fat. Well, that's not going to happen. They don't get along.
No, they hate each other. And, he dropped out of Red Cliff.
And also, that style is just, like, it's been cannibalized so much, he doesn't have anything new to offer. It's like, now you show people those John Woo movies, and they're laughing at you, going, what? Why is this a big deal? Because it's been plagiarized so much.
Oh, I know. They've seen all the stuff. I mean, although, when I saw it in high school, I thought it was amazing, but, you know, that's when The Matrix and stuff was just getting going. And
right, and I by the time I saw The Matrix, I just saw where they were lifting everything, you know. Mm-hmm. So
I know, like
oh, there's
seeing
the
killer. The
oh, there's
and going, oh, this is so cool. And then, you know, reading about it and seeing people saying, well, it was done first here, 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 and here, and then watching those movies and going, oh, okay, this is where it's at, you know.
Yeah. And it was kind of weird for me to see this stuff kind of cannibalize the Hollywood. And the thing is, people like John Woo and Yin Wu Ping had a style you could bring to Hollywood into the sci-fi genre or the crazy cop genre and rip it off. But Liang had a style you cannot bring to Hollywood. It's too Chinese.
Yes, it's
too inherently.
His movies are very
into that martial art. If you don't know that martial arts style or if you don't feel it, you can't make a movie about it.
Right.
You certainly can't make anything on his level. And Liang only worked on one American film, and that movie is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 3.
Oh, that was a stinker.
Yeah.
I mean, those...
And people ask
forget those were Golden Harvest movies.
Right. And somebody asked him, you know, are you going to make an American film? He goes, I made Ninja Turtles 3. I'm done.
It's like, so he shot a lot of the action
on it? He's like, I'm finished. I don't care. I think he choreographed the movie.
Okay.
I don't think he shot the action. It would have actually had action and probably some decent, you know, fight scenes if he'd actually directed them. But no, he was like the stunt choreographer.
Also, would have helped if they would have paid the Jim Henson.
Set him over there because he was the, you know, apparently I always theorized he was the guy sitting at the Golden Harvest Studios at the time when they were looking for a choreographer to send to Canada to help out. They filmed it in Vancouver, so I think Liang got the gig. You know,
yeah.
I don't think I'm too far from that theory.
Yeah. Well, let's wrap this one
but
up.
But yeah, Liang was working at the Golden Harvest Studios.
Yeah. Well, let's wrap this one up.
Okay, the martial arts of Shaolin, you can also Right. $4, Dragon Dynasty, you can find it on Amazon.
Yes. Yeah, I got it for $4 at the store, although I was seeing it at the store constantly, and then when it came time to get it to do this show, I couldn't find it anywhere, but I managed to track it down, and I got it for $4. But it's still in print. You can find it easy.
It's still in print, and it's one of those films that slipped through the cracks back in the 80s, and a lot of people just don't really know about it unless you're a hardcore fan, but once you see it, you can't help but.
Oh,
right. And I was like, you got to buy it.
You have to. It's brilliant. I mean, I think I like Eight Diagrams more just as an artistic statement, but as in terms of like craft, I think Martial Arts of Shaolin is better in terms of craft and overall, like,
It's next level. It's Liang at the next level.
It is. Yeah. Exactly. I like one more as art. I like the other one more purely as a piece of just craft cinema. So, but anyway,
yeah. And
go ahead.
And I'll tell you straight up. It's my favorite Jet Li movie. I like it. I like it more than Fist of Legend or any of these like Once Upon a Time in China films. I like it way more than any of those. Cause it's the real Jet at the peak of his ability and working with the best director he's ever going to work with.
And I have to just sit like with some, but I think that could be the same for me. I don't know.
You'll never see a Jet move like that again. And I think if you watch it back to back with something like Once Upon a Time in China, you'd see how false something like
China has that montage style that doesn't jive with me as well, you know?
Well, as one fan put it, he said it used to be about how many moves you could do at one take, and then it became how many takes can you do on one move,
exactly.
And that's what the 90s stuff is, and just does not settle with me, you know?
No, I want to see the moves
it's like
being
I can't,
done.
I'm just not having it. I got to see the real martial arts, you know? And that's what I get out of the 70s and 80s films that I'm just not getting out of the 90s stuff. When I go back and rewatch them, I'm like, okay, this 90s stuff is hitting my trade-in pile.
Yeah.
I hate to look at stuff like that, but I need space on the shelf for better movies.
I still have Once Upon a Time in China, but I think I sold Once Upon a Time in China 2 a while back. Maybe.
Yeah, and you know, at the time, everybody loved Once Upon a Time in China 2, thinking it was a better film. And I have never been impressed with either. I do have the Sony Columbia DVDs to watch to give them another shot, and I'll make a decision then. They might just hit a trade-in. I'll buy some Johnny Cash CDs.
I like Fearless more than I like the Once Upon a Time in China movies.
I think Fearless is actually his best movie of the last 20 years.
I think that's a great film. That's the only one where I know it's not Jet at his peak and he's doing better moves in this movie, but like as a story, I really like that film.
It's directed by Ronnie Yu, who directed the Eight Diagram Bullfighter remake.
Yep.
But Fearless is a really good film and well worth catching, you know, checking it out.
If you get
a chance to watch that, definitely. Don't miss it. I even liked Unleashed or Danny the Dog.
That's one of his best Western efforts.
It's insane, but the action was Yuen Woo-ping's answer to Ong Bak.
Nice.
If you watch it, it has that brutality, and I think there's even a Muay Thai fighter in there, but it's definitely got the Ong Bak. Hey, we could top Ong Bak with the fights here.
That's one I need to watch.
I like it when a choreographer gives an answer to somebody, you know, to another movie. I could top that Thai stuff.
Well, I had heard that Chui Hark made The Blade as his answer to Ashes of Time.
Oh, yeah, he did. It's a pretty weird film. It was well-liked by fans at the time. I've never been crazy about it. I don't like Ashes of Time either.
I like Ashes of Time, but it's not a good martial arts movie at all.
My problem with it.
A Wong Kar Wai film to its bones.
Yeah. I thought he did a way better job with the Grandmaster. I enjoy the
Grandmaster.
Grandmaster's
a better martial arts movie for sure.
Yeah. I think I'll take hell for it, but I say the Grandmaster's better than the Donnie Yen Ip Man movies. I just don't, those have not hit me the right way.
I haven't seen the Donnie Yen Ip Man movies. They just, on paper, look like Red China propaganda.
They are, and to me, they're on the level of like a Bruce Lee clone film of the 70s. Now we have Ip Man clone movies because he was Bruce Lee's teacher, so he's become a new cultural hero with a completely exaggerated misrepresentation of him, you know, in these Donnie Yen films, which are, you know, act like China won World War II for us.
Oh, sure.
And then the sequel is like a Rocky III ripoff. I'm like, oh, come on.
Yeah, there have been like several sequels to it. But The Grandmaster is a very Wong Kar-wai-ish movie, but I think it reconciles good martial arts with his sort of free-flowing voiceover and images type of filmmaking, you know? Like, very romantic.
Yeah, well, the funny thing is I sent a copy of The Grandmaster to Ron Van Cleef, the film star from the 70s, the Black Dragon, as we know him. He also choreographed fights for Last Dragon. Mm. And he told me he really enjoyed it. And I said, you know what I liked about it, Ron, is that every move meant something. Every movement meant something in the film. Mm. It wasn't just, here's the fight scene and let's go to the next dramatic sequence. It's like every time he moves his hands, it's like, and Ron says, you're exactly right. That's what's missing from the genre.
Yeah, I mean, because Ashes of Time, it's like, I know Sammo Hung worked on it, but the action scenes in it, you can't even see what's going on. It's just complete.
No, you can't tell. Actually, in the 90s, if Sammo Hung's name is in the credits, you could barely tell.
Yeah. I mean, but this one, you know, you could tell that Wong Kar-wai let the choreographers work their magic, you know?
He knew he was filming a martial arts film. He didn't, run away from it like he did with Ashes of Time. Yes. It was really a wuxia film. Wuxia is a totally different genre, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, it is.
But with Sammo kind of retreated on his own style, I think, after Lucky Stars Go Places pissed off everybody in Hong Kong, and they hated him for leaving his wife for this half-white woman, you know, Joyce Golai Hung or Joyce Godenzi or Mina Godenzi.
It's like Clint Eastwood's really, Sandra Locke. People are like, fuck that blonde bitch.
Right, and she's a beautiful woman, and you know, but they didn't approve on leaving your family for, you know, a younger half, you know, hapa haole, as they would say in Hawaii, young woman. But you know, they've been a happy couple since. So, and the funny thing about Liu Jialiang is he always had the younger girlfriends, and he was dating Wei Ying Hung when he was making films with her, like My Young Auntie and Eight Dragon Pole Fighter, and she was half his age. Oh, and then, when they broke up, he was then with he started dating a 20-year-old Vietnamese girl.
He's kind of like Zhang Yimou. Zhang Yimou, like, you know, he was with Gong Li and then he traded up for Zhang Zi, you know?
Liang was a stud back in the, and you look at him, he's no Cary Grant. He's not Paul Newman. But about that kung fu, man, he was like, he kept his knife sharp. Let's just say that.
Yep. Kept his knife.
But definitely check it out. Hit Amazon. If you haven't seen these films, check out Eight Dragon Pole Fighter.
And let us
know. And check out Martial Arts Shaolin.
And let us know what you think. Email us midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com or on Twitter at MMCowboys. And I think that's going to do us for this week. What do you think, John?
Sure.
Any last thoughts? Anything else you want to add?
I think we've given a history lesson. well, other than Liang died, last year, was it?
Yes, he did.
You know, it's kind of, let's try to kind of, you know, have commemorate the great master. And after his death, we said we'd have to do a podcast about it. We finally got around to it,
and so
we'll get around to that Winter Soldier podcast in 3 years.
I missed. I've said this on the podcast before, but when he died, I put up a picture of my collection of his movies, and his daughter commented on it, and she said, "Like, thanks
that
for
is great.
Putting a nice thing up about my dad." I was like,
"Yep, that's so cool."
I was like, "That." I was like, "Wow, cool."
he is. If he's got two films in my top five. He's the man.
He's one of my all-time favorite directors. I think he's one of the greatest. So if you haven't seen any of his movies, watch these. And also check out 36 Chamber of Shaolin, because that's fantastic. And Heroes of the East.
Heroes of the East is like probably the best it gets. And he's probably the real director of Fist of the White Lotus or Clan of the White Lotus, depending on what title you see it, which it says directed by Lo Lie, but supposedly it's actually Liu Jialiang. But he's a really good film, too.
All right, that's going to do us for this week. Next week, I think we're going to have another John and Hunter show. Hope maybe we can wrangle a guest. We'll see. But Stuart's still in the Yabba. We will know more next week.
Right.
well, all right, everybody. Take care. RIP.
All right,
dirty bastard.
Peace out. Bye, pal.
Adios.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to Stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to Facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.